You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On Brand is brought to you by the Brand Driven Digital Event Series, featuring Twitter Brand Basics, a half-day workshop designed to help you take your Twitter presence to the next level. Learn more and register now at twitterbrandbasics.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Patrick Hanlon, one of the leading brand practitioners in the world. He's the CEO and founder of Thinktopia, a global strategic and brand transformation practice for Fortune 100 companies and startups. His book, Primal Branding, is the seminal work that looks at brands as belief systems that people opt into. Hanlon's Primal Branding construct is now recognized by YouTube as their recommended method for designing and attracting social communities. His new book, The Social Code, builds on the concept of primal code outlined in Primal Branding for the digital age. He has been quoted in Fast Company, Business Week Online, Advertising Age, Adweek, Entrepreneur, CNBC, and NPR, as well as media around the world. Hanlon is an online contributor to Forbes, Advertising Age, and others. Patrick, welcome to On Brand.
Thanks, Nick. Great to be here.
You know, we were talking a little bit before I hit record, and this being a new podcast, a new show here, and we were talking a little bit, about what we were going to talk about, and I mentioned, and you kind of reinforced, being one of the first guests here, I kind of said that you're someone that I couldn't imagine anyone else as a first guest, because I think the conversation that I'm trying to tee up here on the On Brand podcast is that though it seems like branding is a part of everything, it's sometimes amorphous and hard for people to get their arms around. And I think that really changed for me a few years ago when, in passing, a colleague gave me a copy. It was one of the original hardcover copies of Primal Branding. And I'd never heard branding broken down in such an easy to understand and communicate to others way. So you're...
Thanks.
You're natural guest one here on
thank you
on the On Brand podcast. But I guess one question I'd back up with after we kind of go through your bio and, you know, being one of the leading brand practitioners in the world, how did you personally come to be an expert in branding?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I came out of advertising. I used to write Super Bowl spots and so forth and work on big campaigns in Manhattan and elsewhere. And it really boiled down to the fact that I was frustrated because every strategic brief I ever received, in between the lines, they wanted to be in the next Nike campaign or the next Apple campaign. And you can't really do that, can you? Other than by imitating them, copying them, which is not very differentiating and usually doesn't work. Yeah. And people were talking about Nike tribes and the Apple cult and so forth, but they really didn't know how to do that for themselves, for their own brands, other than by imitating Nike or Apple. And certainly some people did that. And the discussions of branding back then, and back then we're talking about the turn of the century, and we're really consisted of being very esoteric, and it was like molding fog. And I was working on a client problem. I was in my garden in Wilton, Connecticut, and I was thinking about a project that I was working on with a client. And I started to ask myself why we believe in some companies and some products and services and not in others, which led me to an internal monologue about, well, we start, they have quality that we trust and, you know, features that we enjoy and all of this. But when it really gets down to it, we believe in them and we feel that we belong to them, with them, or to them, and depending what kind of brand that is. And so that really got me into what is a belief system and what is a belief system all about, which got me into, well, I immediately thought of there are icons like the Nike swoosh, you know, and by the way, icons are not only things that you look at, like the American flag, or different kinds of car styles and so forth, but they're also, they engage all the senses, sight, sound, smell, taste, and so forth. The smell of Starbucks coffee, the taste of McDonald's French fries. And anyone who's heard me talk, you know, I've talked about this at sometimes at great length, too long maybe. But the thing is, and then there is a creation story. Apple started in a garage. You know, Nike started with Bill Bowerman pouring plastic into his wife's waffle iron, and things like that. Starbucks started in Seattle. Google started in Stanford, and Facebook started on the East Coast. And you know, they actually have movies about those, right? And so, so once you go through the creation story, then there's also the creed: just do it, think different, belief in life after death, the belief that men and women, all people, should be free, and so forth. And then there are icons. There are also rituals. Starbucks famously changed the way that we have coffee in the morning. Other rituals, if we live in a democratic society, include voting and so forth. And then we have sacred words, which I think is the lexicon. All communities have a group of words that differentiate them. Famously, Starbucks, we all had to learn the words ice grande, skinny, decaf, latte if we wanted to order from Starbucks, right? And even today, you can still see some people standing in front of their menu board trying to figure out what to order. And then there's a group of people we call the non-believers, who are the I used to call them pagans, and in my book Primal Branding, we did call them pagans.
Yeah.
Until I received an email from someone in Australia, I think it was, who was telling me, who told me that the use of that term was politically incorrect. So now we call them non-believers, and these are the people who don't want to sit at your table; they want to sit at some other table. They want to. It's Mac versus PC. It's Democrats versus Republicans. And red states and blue states and so forth. And finally, there's the leader, and that's the person who set out, usually against all odds and against the world at large, in order to recreate that world according to their own point of view, to put a ding in the universe, as Steve Jobs said. And those people include Steve Jobs and Oprah Winfrey and Bill Gates and lots of other people, George Washington, and so forth. And at the top level, what I call the Time Magazine front cover level, but they also involve people at lower levels, other levels within organizations whose job it is to start small teams and be successful and lead groups. And once you bundle these seven elements together, you basically hit all the emotional touch points that we as human beings used to help make sense of the world. And so that, once you have that, you have created a belief system, and you then attract other people who share your beliefs, and that creates community.
You know, I think several of the examples you hit on were Starbucks. And when I've explained the system, when I've, you know, tried to be a big zealot for the book itself, you know, I think it's amazing because those, I think you mentioned this, and you probably say it better, that, you know, not all brands always have all pieces of primal code, but those best ones, those ones that we think of that usually, like you said, in the ad world, people wanting to, you know, they want a Nike ad or an Apple-like ad, those big kind of premier brands are usually ones that are firing on all pieces of the code there.
Absolutely. And, you know, Apple puts out something new every 15 minutes, right?
Yeah.
And whereas, yeah, in some categories you can get away with just a few pieces of the code. But those brands that we call the power brands, the powerful brands, are those that are firing on all seven pieces and are constantly engaging and re-engaging their communities, both their zealots and their potential zealots, and just people, even the non-believers, the people who don't even care about them, hear about what they're doing. Apple is an incredible example of that, and there are others, of course, out there too, Google and others. I'm often asked if you need all of them, and certainly it's better to have all of them. But there are some categories out there that don't have all of them. And for example, the low interest categories like the tire category. There's Michelin. You think of the Michelin Man, Goodyear, and you think of the Goodyear Blimp, and not much more. I guess Michelin has their star rating and so forth for restaurants. But if someone wanted to actually get into the tire category, those brands, Michelin and Goodyear and others, might be at some disadvantage if someone actually came in and fired on all seven pieces of code.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, too, about, you know, Starbucks, where, you know, with the sacred words, where, you know, I find myself now going into other off-brand, non-Starbucks, and still ordering a grande, because they've not only taught me their words, they've almost replaced them within the coffee category.
Exactly. Just don't go in and ask for a grande at a Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah, that would would not go over well. You know, I actually have my copy of The Social Code, your newest book, which I want to talk about in a second. But as I was looking, when I was pulling together pieces for the bio, there was one piece that I actually didn't get in here, but I just remembered when you were talking about different brands. And you talk about you know, the space where people and communities intersect. And it says those communities can be personal brands, civic communities, communities within organizations, social or political movements, or they can surround products and services. And that's interesting because I think in reverse, we often focus more on the ones surrounding products and services. But to me, what really blows me away about the Primal Code is that, and you do this throughout throughout both books, is it does apply to personal brands, to you know, cities, to regions that are markets, to religions, to the United States itself.
Exactly. I mean, the whole thing is that the evolution of brands has gone into social communities, and we talk about people who surround products and services, which you call consumers. We talk about people who surround companies internally, especially, which we call employees or coworkers. We talk about communities of fans who surround actual individuals who are fans. We call them fans. And there are also communities around political and social movements who are voters or activists. There are also communities that surround actual civic communities. We're currently working with a city on the East Coast that wants to quote unquote rebrand themselves. And this is really, the fact is that brands are no longer a deified product or a service endorsed by corporations. Instead, brands have now become, and this has happened very quickly, like over the last 7 years, I think, become connected clusters of people who believe in the same things, they act the same way, they talk the same language, they use a system of identifiers to signify who they are. They might dress a certain way, or they might wear a cheese head on their head if they're a Packers fan or something like that. So they're easy to identify in that case. But these clusters of people, these communities have become extremely powerful. And what the social code does then is illustrates how to design and attract that community and create a group of supporters who become so passionate about your success that they're actually willing to create it themselves. And those people, they may be funding you. They might be your customers. They might be your vendors. That might be your bank. Excuse me. It might be friends. It might be your friends. It might be your parents. You know. And we talk about not only products and services being brands, but we also talk about the brand called you, right? And so people who sit across the desk from the buyers at Walmart or Target or wherever, who are able to string together this narrative that includes the creation story, the creed, icons, and so forth. You don't obviously point out, hey, these are my icons, or now let's listen to my sacred words. But if you're able to talk about, here's where I'm from, here's what I believe in, this is our product or the service that we're talking about describing, this is how you use it, which is different than the way you use our competitors or other things that are out there. Here's the vocabulary that we use, the way we describe it, which is different and unique. And that description may just include products and features, features and benefits. Product features and benefits. This is what we're not and never want to become, or this is what I'm not and never want to become. This is not the way I work. And here's who's leading it. Then you have put together a narrative, a strategic brand narrative, that people can respond to. And they just feel that you have your stuff together. You know, you've really thought it through, you've worked it out, you're hitting, but what you're actually doing is hitting all the emotional touch points that we as human beings are in some cases hardwired to respond to be alerted to. And instead of walking away and leaving them with the perception that, well, they don't really have it figured out, or they don't have their act together, or it's just kind of feeling kind of squishy to them, you walk away with the sale, or you walk away with the investment, the capital, whatever you're trying to do, hopefully.
Yeah. In speaking and writing, you know, so much, it seems like brand is a safer label too, because sometimes you talk to someone that's not a business, or you talk with something that's not an organization, it's a community or it's a personal brand, but you take all of that away. And what everyone is really trying to do is build some sort of a brand. I mean, you talked about that investment. I always say that, you know, a brand is any noun, a person, place, or thing that needs something from someone else, whether that's an investment, a donation, advocacy. And you know, like you said, you don't go around saying these are our sacred words. But I think in reverse, what you can see the difference between, you know, you mentioned the Packers. My father's a Packers fan. My son's a Packers fan. So by default, I am also a Packers fan. But you look at a team like that with a raving fan base compared to another less committed group of fans, and you start to look at what's different, and you can start to see those pieces of code, the visual icons, the sacred words, the leaders, all of it.
That's right. And what we do with when we're working together with brands, clients or otherwise, we deconstruct them into their pieces of code. We say, well, what's your creation story? What do you believe in? What are your icons? And there we find out then very quickly if they have those things, first of all, and then we determine if they're still relevant, if they still resonate with people. And a lot of times they've lost their relevance. And so we have to recreate that, re-engineer that. And certainly it becomes a question sometimes of authenticity when you're working with the Fortune 100 company and the product has not been developed by two guys in a garage and you're trying to be authentic and so forth and have it resonate. However, when you're talking about Kickstarters, yeah. People who are inventing new products and services, as they are everywhere it seems, having this narrative really gives them an unfair advantage over their competition because they have it figured out and they've activated all the pieces and they're really kicking in all seven cylinders, so to speak.
Well, and that's the thing, because I think that the startup conversation is everywhere, and one of the biggest pieces is you're looking at all of these, probably more startups, than any period in history. And one of the big things, like you said, we focus so much on, you know, maybe the product side of innovation, which is important, but the story that goes with it, I think, is the big part of making it or breaking it.
Absolutely. And, of course, storytelling and narrative, everyone's talking about that these days and coming at it from every angle possible. But I think the thing is that in order to – and, of course, we respond as human beings to stories. And once you wrap around a story around something, what you're really doing is taking it from a meaningless product or service, in the case of marketing, to becoming more meaningful. And the more meaningful you can make that product or service, the better off you are in the end. And that's how you design and attract passionate fans, and which is obviously important, and the end game.
You know, one thing, as I look at my dog-eared copy of The Social Code that I totally forgot about for being a system in a book that I reference so much, your first book, Primal Branding, we're talking about how relevant all of this is today. Mind-boggling that it really predates the rise of social media. I mean, some of those sites were around then in very nascent forms, but from what we know of as the social culture of, you know, Facebook, Twitter, everything else, that was not the force in brand building and marketing that it is today. And all of it fits, which I suppose, given your afterword or your author's note here at the end, was really why you put the social code together.
Yes. When I wrote, of course, I came up with the idea for the primal construct in 2001. And I shared it with some friends of mine, some of whom worked at American Express and other places and large organizations. And I said, well, this is a different way of looking at things, and I want to make sure that I'm not crazy. So would you please take a look at it? And we talked about it, and, you know, we tweaked a few things, but substantially it was about right. And a friend of mine very graciously offered me a speaking spot for their organization that was going to be in October, I think it was, of 2001. And I thought, well, I'll just wait until September. Nothing happens in New York City in this summer. And so I'll wait for fall to really go out and start to talk about this. And of course, then September 11th happened and the whole world flipped on its head. Yeah. But I spoke to hundreds and hundreds of audiences, people and audiences around the world, really, who looked at me with, you know, X's in their eyes when I started talking about social community and how important community was. They were just concerned with customers, consumers, and so forth. And so, of course, over time now, this has evolved into something. And what I needed to do in the social code was really reflect the way that our feelings and our thoughts and our perspectives on branding have evolved so that we really start talking about social communities. And both that and the fact that I was talking in Primal Branding about AOL Instant Messenger, which I had to change. And when I wrote it out, obviously, Facebook wasn't really around yet. It was still something that some people were doing out on the East Coast. Twitter, Pinterest, and everyone else was not around. Google was around, of course, but yeah. Some of the things we have today, Uber and others that we take for granted these days, just did not exist then, LinkedIn and so forth. So I needed to reflect that.
So for those that don't have the benefit of having both books, which I'd strongly recommend, Primal Branding is what you'd think of as a traditional sized business book of a couple hundred pages. What I loved, because I did not read the product description real carefully. We'd been talking, and I went and grabbed a copy of The Social Code, and I was surprised at what came in the mail in that it is a smaller book of about 70 pages here. And if I didn't hate the word so much, I'd call it a manifesto. But I, There's not another word for that. But I loved the feel of this book, and I am a slow reader. I admittedly pore over things, read and reread sections, but it's one that I was able to take on a long lunch and just kind of enjoy and take a bunch of notes in the margin. But there are, it's 70 pages. There are no chapters. It's just one continuing flow of things. And it's also bookended by this story of you speaking. I don't want to give too much away, but I guess if we stray at all from branding, as someone that writes, I really found this an interesting way to, you don't often see a business concept presented in a way like this. How did you, you know, beyond the content in the book, which we can talk a bit about, the form that this took, where was your head at there?
Well, I always say that it's longer than Leaves of Grass, but shorter than War and Peace. We looked at the design, and just as social communities have changed in the last 7 years, amazingly, with their growth and everything, the way that we perceive things has also changed and evolved. I mean, who would think that we're looking at little, I mean, I don't know how many pixels our icons are on our iPhone, but not very many. And we look at those things that are smaller than postage stamp size. I mean, postage stamps used to be the reference point for making things small. Well, we're about a quarter of the size of postage stamps these days, depending what stamp you're looking at. And still, we identify them. They resonate for us. We work with them constantly. And so the same thing is with reading. A lot of people don't like to read. Some people only like to read electronically. Many, many people, especially the audience that I want to talk to, don't read at all and prefer podcasts and prefer videos and prefer other modes. And so what I wanted to do was to make, I should mention Christopher Brand was the designer, the book designer that helped me on all this, was to make it both easy to read. So it's, I think it's 20 point or 24 point type. Make it easy and quick to read. And there are even pages in the back for note-taking and so on. And so it really is and was intended to be and designed to be a quick read that you can do basically on one flight or what? Actually, it's one bus ride probably, depending on how fast you read.
Yeah, lunch.
That really contains everything.
Yeah, long lunch at Panera did it for me.
A long lunch at Panera, exactly. And so, or a morning coffee at Starbucks. And so, but really includes everything that was in the larger book, but is more relevant today for those who are doing all the incredible work that's happening in Silicon Valley today and elsewhere around the world.
Well, speaking of Silicon Valley, I you know, was just leafing through it, and I found a few things that I underlined. You talk about that neck of the woods and everywhere, really, where there's all sorts of, you know, great startup communities. But I found myself underlining a part where you said, most new ventures fail because nobody cares.
Yeah.
And I think there's all these great branding sentiments that people kind of nod along with, but then they really don't know how to do anything about it. And like you said, that's where articulating the different pieces of the code, you know, come in, where, you know, it's hard to say, okay, make me a brand, make someone care. But doing something like that, I think that connects to this other piece where you say social code helps manage the intangibles of your community. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, what some of those intangibles are and maybe how people can bring those into focus?
Yes. The intangibles really are the feelings associated with your brand, with your product or service, with your community. And those intangibles, I mean, how do you lever up a feeling or an emotion about whatever you're trying to do, about your concept? And what primal branding really gets at, especially when we're talking about icons and we're talking about rituals, and we're talking about belief systems and the creed, and there's a lot of talk today about our values, whether they're social or economic or whatever. And the way to get at these and the way to really drive influence or preference or likability and so forth, is to adjust these levers and to create things that are truly exciting for people, that resonate with people, that mean something to people. And once you are able to go through, and I guess in some ways it's a check off the boxes exercise, at least in the beginning, of do we have a creation story? What is our creed? Have we figured it out? What are our icons? Do we have any rituals that are different? How do we talk about this thing? What is it not? What do we never want it to become? And who's leading it? The creed, for example, I was with some people who had created a $1 billion business. They were in their 20s and 30s, a gaming company. And we spent 3 hours talking about why they came to work in the morning. And so some of these things, for example, the creed, are big questions. And, you know, why are we here? Why do we come to work in the morning? Why do I come to work in the morning? And why do I come to work in the morning at this place? And so some of these are big questions. Some of them are easier to answer. But when you pull them all together, you create this surround, this holistic surround that makes sense and makes it believable and meaningful. And once that starts to happen, you feel that you belong within this community and you share that passion with other people who are equally as passionate about that community. And once that starts happening, a lot of buzzy things start going on.
Yeah. You know, I also, another thing I think I double underlined here was you talking about selfies mattering. And I think it's a funny kind of somewhat tug of war between people that love selfies and people that hate selfies. And I put myself somewhere in between of, I don't know that I personally take a ton of selfies, but I recognize that they have tremendous amount of brand value. And I think that you do too. Can you talk a little bit about the role something as vain or harmless or self-centered or whatever people preconceived notions about selfies are, about why they matter, just a little bit?
Well, I think they're iconic, and I think they matter to some extent, but I don't know that they matter that much. I think that the thing is that when you are creating a brand community and you want it to be unique and differentiated from everyone else that's out there, and you want to create programs that are that only your community can enjoy. Burning Man is a huge community. And, you know, they almost expel people who don't belong there, and they're pretty easy to pick out. Mm-hmm. I'm probably one of them. Yeah, but I think that we have a tendency in marketing. 20 years ago, everyone had to go to conferences. They had to go to NASCAR. They had spent money in NASCAR. What's our NASCAR budget? What's our Super Bowl budget? It's another one. Running off to Super Bowl because everyone else is going there. Hashtag programs and selfies and so forth seem to be one of those areas where it just gives people an easy out to get into social media and so forth without really thinking it through, without really understanding what your brand is all about. Once you understand what your brand is all about, you can understand that, hey, I don't think NASCAR is particularly right for us, and neither is the Super Bowl, and neither is a hashtag program. And so but we can create something else that is uniquely our own that our community will really get into and will respond to and makes them feel like that they themselves are unique, that they are doing something that is both fun and exciting as being a member of our community. And the other thing I should mention right away about communities is that we as individuals are made up of, we're engaged in a lot of different communities. We have our family, we go on Facebook, we hike, we play basketball, we play poker, we play soccer, we go to Starbucks, we shop on Amazon, and we know French or things like that. And you don't take the, you know, if you or you're an accountant or a lawyer or a doctor or a marketing person, and you don't take the language, the vocabulary, the sacred words, lexicon, whatever you want to call it, from one of those groups and take it to another. You don't start talking about medicine while you're playing poker, or you might, but you don't use the same words. You might do it casually in conversation, but you don't start using poker words on the operating table. And so we have to understand that we are all, we belong to many different communities in our lives, hopefully, and we feel that we belong there.
So if there was someone starting from scratch, blank piece of paper, and beyond the seven pieces of code, what would be the one thing that you'd tell them?
I get this asked this question all the time, and I just got off the phone with someone earlier today. We were talking about this. There isn't really a one thing. The one thing, I guess, is to figure out what your narrative is, which is seven things, construct. And so that is the one thing, because that's what will help you figure out how to differentiate yourself and whatever your project is, and start to rally support around it.
You know, it's because you often hear people that are kind of shopping for what it is they need, and they need to fix this perceived branding problem, and they don't really know what item they can put in their cart that will help them do that. And I think you kind of bridge that too by saying that, you know, when you're shopping to solve that brand problem, that you're really looking for the narrative, and the narrative is what the seven pieces of code solve.
Yeah, I think that it's not companies or brands or their products get into trouble for different reasons. And there may be a perception problem where they may need to run a counter narrative. There may be a product problem, or there may be an awareness problem. And again, just the overriding thing is what we do is we start to deconstruct it and see where what parts are in the primal code are actually in there and functioning, and what things may be off,
yeah,
or might need to be refreshed.
Well, as we start to wrap up a little bit, you know, you're someone that talks to and about lots of different brands, is obviously probably has trouble not seeing them everywhere. Is there one in particular that has been making you smile a lot lately? And I won't qualify smile as being good, bad, but that you think is getting it.
Oh, I'm always energized by all the new brands that are coming up today. That like the Warby Parkers, Ubers. Although Uber is running into some problems right now,
yeah, a little bit.
I think that just their connectivity and their not only their technological connectivity, but how they ramped up so immediately and so quickly. I guess immediately is quickly, but how they were able to ramp up first in San Francisco and then in other places, geographies around the U.S. and then the world. The service isn't always different, but I'm energized by that, and I'm also interested in how other organizations kind of do that and then start to teeter off. And I think that that's a function of them kind of forgetting what made them successful, as Trout and Reese used to say,
yeah,
or just the things that we used to value no longer became valuable for them. And so they kind of faded off. But that's speaking in code, I think, a little bit. But I look at Starbucks today, and it was such a huge success when I wrote Primal Branding, which was, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, the first book. And, you know, they certainly went through some rites of passage,
yeah,
especially in 2008, 2009, like everyone else on the planet. And the way they've come out of it, you know, I can't walk into a Starbucks these days without feeling that I'm interrupting a conversation behind the counter. I don't know how the rest of your listeners feel, but that's the way I feel. And that's the same at a lot of other retail places, too, where you feel that they're having a party that you're not a part of. And that, you know, gets in the way of me feeling like I'm a member of that community anymore.
Well, you know,
so it's interesting that what we used to call screen to shelf continuity, you know, what you saw in the advertisement, being the same thing that you found, or was promised in the advertisement, being the same thing that you found when you got to retail. And there's a sort of a disconnectedness also when it comes to modern day brands, well, in kind of a different way.
It is. It's interesting because, you know, that's one thing that hasn't changed with digital, because if there's a brick and mortar component to your store, there's still that risk of, you know, all of the great touch points you have in place could totally be overridden by something as simple as crosstalk.
Exactly. And, yeah.
But then you think of Warby Parker, who they have a few brick and mortar locations, but they're really the exception, not the rule. And they're able to control that experience, how you open their box and, you know, try things on and share what you find and everything else.
Well, I think they're a great example of someone who has created a new model using the internet and digital media to make it exceptional and make it different. And they do have a bricks and mortar presence. And that presence does not disrupt your feelings of belonging to that community, quirky as that community may be.
And that they've reinvented that experience and made it, you know, it's still, you know, digitally based,
yeah,
primarily, but they haven't done so at the expense of the personal touch, you know, that you still get with it, which is not, I would say, is probably a bigger challenge in places more business moves online, is to still, you know, find ways to, you know, give your brand some humanity too.
Well, I think they seem to be high touch even online, and they remain high touch when you go in.
Yeah.
Which is difficult to do.
So, now that we've come to this point, what is a fun fact about yourself that someone might only find in your new on-brand podcast interview?
Well, I have just as many guitars as I have daughters.
I don't know how many daughters or guitars you have, so I have to ask the follow-up question.
I have five.
Five daughters. Well, this is now we can have this this bonding moment. I don't have five daughters, but I have five kids, so I know that they're.
Oh wow!
We're in the minority.
We are.
And people always give us that kind of look, and they when you say five, you know, it's
we're our own community, Nick.
We are. We absolutely are.
Let those non-believers beware.
I know. Yeah, you always have to explain. You have to do some follow-up work after that and kind of assure that you are not crazy.
A little bit. There's a little bit of work involved with that. Yeah, a little bit of explanation. And But they're all wonderful, so
absolutely.
It doesn't matter.
Absolutely. So where's the best place for people to learn more about you, what you do?
Thinktopia.com.
Thinktopia.com, links to all the books, everything will be there. Well, Patrick, thank you for joining us on.
Hey, Nick, it's been a fun bunch of minutes. How long has it been? I'm not sure. An hour?
We are clocking in at about 45 for the official show length.
Excellent.
But thank you again.
Thanks so much. This is fantastic. And thanks for everyone. If you got this far, listen this far.
Awesome. And finally, a big thanks to a mentor of this podcast and resource that you should all know more about. Jay Baer of Convince and Convert has done it again. In addition to being a digital marketing thought leader, speaker, and best-selling author, he's now created a new online resource for indexing all of the great marketing podcasts out there. It's called, wait for it, Marketing Podcasts, and you can find it at marketingpodcast.com. If you like marketing and podcasts, you need to check it out. A few reminders. We'll link up to everything, including Thinktopia, as well as links for all of Patrick's books at branddrivendigital.com. That's where you can also subscribe to the show via iTunes, Stitcher, RSS. Speaking of iTunes, iTunes ratings and reviews are critical to all podcasters like this one. So if you like the show, head over there. Go ahead and click those stars. Give us a rating. Drop in a couple of comments, let others know what you liked most about the On Brand podcast, and don't forget that this is brought to you by our Brand Driven Digital Event Series. Learn more at Twitter Brand Basics. or learn more about Twitter Brand Basics, Digital Strategy Bootcamp, and the industry-leading Social Brand Forum at branddrivendigital.com. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.